For the ancient Greeks, the absurd was closer to the profound than the tragic was. This occupied his mind as Jamal looked down like the gods of Olympus. Below the railing of the spectators' gallery, the squealing, teeming carnival of the wounded and the blinded statesmen, this circus of wailing, flailing, rich and powerful, these gore-choked, gasping clowns, were the pinnacle of human folly. Hilariously, they hunched forward and tried to gather armfuls of their own burst, stinking intestines. Their pale hands held together the brains spilling from their shattered skulls. These were the same pencil-pushing bureaucrats who'd voted moments before to send him and all of his friends to be similarly resolved. As Jamal picked off target after target, his every muzzle flash another old man, a thought flashed. The professor, Dr. Brawley, in anthropology had explained a theory about pratfall humor. The gags wherein someone trips and falls suddenly. Those bits of clumsy physical comedy. According to anthropologists, we laugh out of some prehistoric reflex. When primitive man was prey, when he and his tribe ran in terror from a saber-toothed tiger or whatever, the man who fell would be eaten. For everyone else, his death would occur as a huge relief. According to Brawley, all humor arises from escaping death. For years, Jamal had walked in constant terror. Before he was registered for, not the draft, he and his friends called it registering for the death. Before the idea of another world war had ever appeared on the horizon, he'd known he'd die young. Nerve gas raped in battle. Instead, from today onward, he was the saber-toothed tiger. The pain in Bing's trigger finger meant more to him than the bullet-shattered old men who crawled across the smeared marble floor beneath him. His rifle's blast bothered him more than their screams. The recoil of the rifle butt against his shoulder hurt him more than the shot-to-shit political Brahmins who tried to claw past each other for another moment of life. He and other members of his lineage stood in the gallery, a vantage point they'd occupied and filmed from for weeks. They knew every avenue of escape a target might take. They'd taken positions to shoot around any obstacles on the floor below. The screams made it easy. The screaming made Bing hate them more, if that was possible. These old ladies and old men who couldn't tell the truth. Every statement they'd made was hedged and qualified and conditional. These screams constituted the first honest sound out of their mouths since adulthood. What a sight. Rich old men pounding and pushing, climbing over one another to find safety. They stampeded like panicked fat cats, wrestled, piling themselves against locked exit doors. They huddled and wept beneath desks. For helmets, they opened thick volumes of law and held those books cupped over their heads. It helped for Bing to envision the mass roundup and culling of wild animals. A video had circulated between members of his tribe. It showed footage of dolphins, corralled in nets and clubbed as the seawater itself foamed into a bloody froth. That slippery, squirming mass of the dead and dying. It was harder for Bing to watch the beautiful dolphins die than it was to see the suited statesman die. On the internet, he'd watched wild rabbits stampeded into pens. Great leaping waves of rabbits heaving in one direction, then another, as men waded among them and crushed their skulls with metal hammers. Bing had watched the videos of kangaroos and baby seals. The culling of legislators was nothing compared to the clubbing of tiny baby harp seals. The recoil of the rifle butt ramming his shoulder. That pain stoked Bing's anger and made him take aim at every sign of movement in the chamber below. With the blessing of the police, these skirmishes took place. For the police had already been sacrificed for political correctness, and the mass extermination of the young was prevented by forfeiting a comparatively tiny number of those already near death, who'd already raised their children and been feted. The courtroom, the assembly chambers and on-location newscasts, the lecture halls, they stunk of gun smoke and spilled shit. Not until the snipers gave the go-ahead did the harvesters venture among the dead. Here a seemingly dead body screamed at the knife point, and a target was found to be playing opossum. Here Bing was summoned to come down from the gallery, and the target shrieked so cowardly that it was a pleasure to see him dead. Things happened too fast to think. Something moved and Charlie would squeeze off a shot, transfixed. His eyes watched for motion. Movement across his retina. Something alive. Any motion seemed to bypass his brain, his conscience, and put him in a trance state the same as playing video games. Same as a dog watching a squirrel or a cat waiting at a mouse hole. Or like his own old man on a riverbank watched the same red and white fishing bobber afloat there in the water, waiting for a trout to take a bite. The trance kept him from imagining what was no doubt happening to his mother and father at the same moment. Any thinking he'd done a time ago. In the back of his mind, Charlie had mulled over his reasons for taking part. He'd lost faith in all the regular, gradual methods for self-improvement. After a lifetime of posting on blogs and videotaping his every move and emotion for social media, he was facing nothing less than identity fatigue. There were no more fresh starts. He'd established his brand so thoroughly, documented himself for posterity. There was no frontier where the internet hadn't already told the world all about him since he'd first learned to keyboard. Adjustment Day would give him a fresh start. Whether it worked or not, it would be a radical shift. He'd be dead or in prison or a revolutionary hero. But any of those would be an improvement on the happy, sad, hopeful, fearful, ordinary nobody the online world could watch, getting older, getting taller, but never actually getting anywhere. Suppressing hysterical laughter, he popped rich men and wealthy old women, only pausing to reload. Charlie went for kill shots to the back of the skull, an entrance wound at the top of the spine with the exit wound through the screaming mouth. Less cleanup that way. Protein is amazing shit, he knew. It was the glue that sticks to everything. Cut a body in half with an AK, and your lineage will still have to scrape away all the scraps. Welling up from deep inside him was something. A feeling. Something enormous. The only word for it was glee. For the first time in his life, he didn't need to worry about the draft. He'd never given his future much thought, because the draft or nuclear war had always loomed there. It was inevitable that after he turned 18, he'd die. But here, for the first time, he could see a future. From this point on, he had some control. All his life he'd been taught that men were protectors and guards, and that the most noble destiny he could attain would be to die in order to preserve another person's life. If humor comes from anything, it arises from an immense feeling of relief. Charlie felt joy now because, for once, death was outside him. The scene below him was ugly as ugly gets, bloody as bloody gets, but it wasn't the worst that could happen. According to the Talbot book, history would never know its greatest mistake because no one would be left to record it. The task at hand looked like a bloodbath, but it most certainly preempted a nuclear war, a global famine, a pandemic that wiped out billions. All his life, Charlie had been told that he and his kind were the evil patriarchal oppressors, the haters who'd colonized the globe and enslaved the gentle savages of Rousseau's paradise. Thank you, academics. Charlie could wear that. The worse than Hitler label. Today, he'd give people the proof they were right. It was like those news stories where they'd interview the neighbors and lifelong best friends of a serial killer, and everyone swore the killer was a regular, friendly, nicest fella on earth. After Adjustment Day, the world would know a new truth about Charlie Good Guy 144. He was tired of learning history. He wanted to be it. Charlie wanted the history of the future to be him. Senator Daniels lay still among his dead colleagues. He'd burrowed and wormed his body between the leaden corpses until their blood soaked through his custom-tailored suit. He'd been among the first to take cover, and the slaughtered had toppled, staggering and tumbling, and fallen beside and upon him. He'd felt the twitches and little kicks as the life had gone out of bodies. Their blood painted the hair flat to his head and gummed his eyes shut. Blood stuck his pants tight to the skin of his thin legs and webbed his fingers. His breaths were the quick, shallow sniffs of a rabbit playing dead. He lay face down atop his hands to hide their trembling. The gunshots had stopped. The screams also. Voices moved through the room. Men's words and the grunts of exertion. The weight on his back lifted and was gone. The body beside him was pulled away. A hand gripped him around one upper arm, and Daniels felt himself being rolled face up. His breathing stopped as he let himself be dragged by one arm, a skidding distance across the stone floor, slick with blood. The hand let go, and he let his arm fall limp, and he continued not to breathe. He lay frozen with shock, but sweating off his mask of blood, fearful shivering would betray him. Fingertips pinched his ear, and a jagged agony bit at his head where the top of his ear met his scalp. The senator screamed, tearing open his sticky eyelids, and his lips pasted together. The fingers had released their grip. A man stood over him, a savage wearing camouflage-patterned bib overalls and holding a hunting knife. A laborer from the barbecue the night before. His latex-gloved hand was smeared with red, but not barbecue sauce. His eyes met the senator's for a moment, green eyes, wide with surprise. Daniels whisper begged, "Please," praying for pity, for the savage to move along and leave him among the dead. Tears sprang to his eyes and washed clean streaks down his face. Instead, the man twisted his head toward the other voices and called, "Got a live one!" Discovered, Daniel struggled to sit up. Around him, similar bloodied savages looked up from where they were waiting among the dead. The heaps and drifts of bodies and half-bodies and headless bodies and desks smashed to scraps of wood. A nearby savage held something bloody between two fingers before tucking it into his hip pocket. This other man called back, "Put him with the leftovers." And with his own dripping hunting knife, the man pointed across the chamber. There, a cluster of weeping men squatted against a wall, bald and pot-bellied, skeletal and stooped. Like him, they were old men drenched in other people's blood. A third savage, a few steps away, was leaning over, sawing at someone with his knife. He lifted something small that trailed a thin coil of wire. The wire stretched down to lift a small box. When the coiled wire in the box fell away from the man's hand, Daniels realized it had been a hearing aid. What the man held was a severed ear, which he stuffed into his back pocket. The man who stood over Daniels smiled. It was a wicked, lopsided smile, but not without pity. "You remember that hole outside?" He jerked his head toward the bloody group of survivors. "You guys' job." With his knife, he gestured broadly over the butchered. "You're going to pile this big mess into that hole. Got it?" Daniels' fingers crept to his ear, to where the pain still burned. They felt the warm blood still streaming, still warm. Not dead. "Now go," ordered the smiling savage. "Get with your friends." Senator Daniels nodded slowly before scrambling to his feet. Back in before times, before the pits were being filled, Driving back to Portland, Oregon, Walter had taken turns with Talbot Reynolds, yelling out a game they'd invented to keep proving he was alive. At the wheel, Walter would yell, "A1 steak sauce!" From inside the trunk, Talbot would yell, "Formula 409. Walter would yell, "7 up!" Talbot would yell, "Chanel number 5. Walter, WD-40. A lull would fall over the car. Only the sound of Idaho had rushed around them like a tunnel. Here were all Walter's dreams, of romancing Shasta with money, of rising above the economic mysteries that submerge most people. His dreams might be dead in the trunk. In his head had been the idea to turn around and hunt down an alternate mentor. Yes, to bury this dead one and locate a replacement. Then a voice would yell out, "I could have had a V8. Joy. Everything in the world would make sense and wouldn't be just jumbled chaos. The dead were brought back to us. Jubilant, Walter would forget this was a rental, and he'd put a match to a fatty. This would eat up the miles until Talbot Reynolds would yell, "Enough!" From the depths of the trunk, he'd yell, "I hope you love the taste of fat white Nazi dick!" They were tallied, the dumped-out sacks of ears. The ears dug from pockets, black ears and white ears, ears plugged with hearing aids, ears dangling hoop earrings, ears hairy with age and ears streaked with orange tanning spray. In each statehouse, a Garrett Dawson or a Jamal Spicer addressed the small remaining group of trembling, bloodied leftovers. "You will remain," he read from the approved page of the Talbot book. "You survive to do the bidding of the voting lineages and conduct all necessary business." Those allowed to survive would bury the dead. "You neither propose or impose any new laws. You will serve as merely clerks." The men reading these lines in courthouses and college lecture halls said, "Your term will be for life. And if you fail at your duties, a vote of the electorate can call for your execution." The Talbot book made it sound simple. Only people who'd harvested targets on the list would get to vote. The tally of each target, combined, determined the number of votes each lineage was allotted. The reason being that only people with votes had made their sacrifice for the cause. This ensures that nobody hijacks the movement, because the people who racked up the most numbers will ally with each other and elect one of their own, and because only these people will have the gumption to hold on to power via the same action they took to attain it. Officially, liberated assets are supposed to go to the new government to offset the cost of establishing the correct system, and they go to compensate displaced persons forced to forfeit property due to relocation to the correct jurisdiction. "Once the bodies are resolved," read each man to his captives, "your first item of governmental business is to institute the Homeland Relocation Act." Back before this book was a book, on the ride back to Portland, Oregon, Talbot Reynolds had been locked in the car's trunk, always going, "You'd better get used to being some passed-around prison bitch getting your shithole sold for cigarettes." As he'd told it, Talbot had a surgically implanted tracking chip. Implanted, he wouldn't say where, but just under his skin. It gave off a GPS signal that the FBI would use to find him. Once the car stopped, it would only require an hour or two for agents to triangulate the chip's location. He'd cited kidnapping laws going back to the Lindbergh baby, saying, "You're going to learn all the subtle flavor differences between Nazi dick and black dick and mestizo." Even as Walter had marched him down the basement stairs of an abandoned house and he'd strapped the old man to a heavy chair. Some tiny device had been pinging their whereabouts. Any minute now, the outside door would bust open, and he'd be busted, awaiting trial, convicted, sentenced to serve with not another moment of Shasta. Game over. Unless he could find and excise this homing device. Cut it out of the old man's hide, wherever it was buried. Just one flick with a razor blade, a swipe with rubbing alcohol, a little digging, and it would be Walter's to crush under the heel of his shoe. Close the wound, wounds, death by a thousand paper cuts. With this in mind, Walter had rounded up a bottle of rubbing alcohol, a razor blade, bandages, and superglue, preparing for his treasure hunt. He'd sliced the clothes off the old man, looking for a little scar to indicate where the chip was buried, cutting the seams and peeling away the arms of the suit, the collar of the shirt, as if he were peeling an orange. Starting from the extremities, the wrists and the ankles, and working his way inward, he'd find a lump on one forearm and ask, "Is this it?" Talbot had tensed, going, "Find out." Walter had swabbed on rubbing alcohol to clean the skin, then sunk in one corner of the razor blade. His fingers slippery, sliding, slimy with blood. Him without latex gloves, his fingernails rimed with red, his eyes overflowing in sympathy. This not being any Walter who Walter had ever planned to be. Somebody who tortures an old man strapped to a chair, razor-blading a hole in one arm, picking carefully around the bigger veins and tendons. The hunt had turned up a cyst. The search had to go on. Walter had peeled back enough pant leg to discover a small hardness in the skin covering a wasted calf muscle. He'd looked up at the wincing, flinching, giggling Talbot and asked, "Is it here?" Giggling Talbot, the crazy old geezer clearly getting off on Walter's squeamish agony, he'd gone, "You'll be very popular in prison." Forcing Walter to slosh on more alcohol, rubbing to locate the little hardness under the skin, trying to pinch it, to hold it in place as he sinks the razor blade next to it. Except the hardness slips. It migrates, sliding under the hairy skin, skin now greasy with blood. Forcing Walter's razor blade to chase after it, making a little incision longer, making it cut sideways to follow, finally striking pay dirt only to fish out another false alarm. A lump of fat. Despite his new old man springing leaks all over, if Walter hit some spot in a certain way, the blood would spout like so much ketchup-colored jizz, with a smell like mashing it with some babe who's been dead and buried in the ground for the past 10 years. Old Talbot, always shaking, then with laughter, not holding still, tears streaming down his cheeks and every wrinkle in his face stretched tight. He'd squirmed against the belts holding his arms to the arms and his legs to the legs of the chair. The death by a thousand cuts wasn't killing, but it was paring away, flaying, whittling away the human part of Walter, so that the next likely lump was less effort to excavate, and the one after that took no effort to lance. The blood, at first so alarming, had faded to only an annoyance, and Walter's sympathy had soured to rage. After that, he dug indiscriminately. The empathy burned out of him. Walter had dug to torture the old man for not telling him the chip's location from the start, slicing him to strips of bait so the old man would tell, would cry uncle, only to have Talbot keep laughing, swearing at Walter's ineptness as the razor blade had to trench and explore across the man's scalp and down his back, and Walter began splashing cold alcohol on cuts already open to rinse them, so he'd not cut them a second time. And Talbot's head had hung limp on his neck, his face pale and his laughter reduced to a hissing, like someone laughing in his sleep. For fortitude, Walt had surfed porn on his phone. His favorite clips, the clips that featured only dead people fucking and giving blowjobs. Alive when they were filmed, but dead now. The fact that they could still excite him, even from beyond the grave, was the most proof of a human soul he'd ever found. Those carnal saints, their ancestral beauty had made it okay to slice up somebody who remained only flesh and blood. Still, Walter's fingertips had found no chip, no diode, only lumps of scar tissue. Just clumps of fat or warm cysts he'd had to pinch out and examine to be sure. Precancerous cell clusters, calcified foreign objects, bits of gravel or tiny cubes of safety glass, leftover souvenirs from a car or a bicycle crash a lifetime ago. Walter had carved away the t-shirt and boxer shorts, rubbing his wet fingers in little circles, searching for that foreign anything that even now was relaying his location. This abandoned house, this bloody crime scene, him dripping with sweat, wincing in sympathy as he swiped the razor blade only to uncover a bolus of fat, an enlarged lymph node, something hard and firm, or an ingrown hair, the stink of a carbuncle bursting in his face, a boil he'd lanced by accident. His new old man flinching to make the blade go wrong, laughing, hysterical. The police tracing the ping. The silent distress call. The police every ping getting that much closer. After adjustment day, the book was everywhere. To be seen without a copy of the blue-black book was to risk being reported. What came of that, no one was sure. Despite it having broken her nose, Terence's mother had allowed him to keep his copy. Urine and colloidal silver dappled the pages, but he could still read the notes his father had made for him. Among them was a list. On the final blank page, under the heading, "My Dreams for You," his father had written, "Excellent health and strength, high status, wisdom, courage, becoming a great healer." In bed, Terence continued to begin each day by reading. Today, for instance, the Talbot Book decreed, "The American of the formerly United States was constantly held in check. His schooling was comprised of the constant repetition of the same narrative model. In the most classic stories of American fiction, the ones most promoted by critics in the school system, the same fates befall each of three main characters. The meek and obedient destroys himself. The most aggressive and openly rebellious is murdered. And no one, except the often mute yet always watchful character, is left behind to recount the story. A suicide, a murder, a witness. Always the suicide occurs first. This is a childlike innocent. In One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, it's the obedient son, Billy Bibbit, who's committed himself to a mental hospital in order to please his mother. After sex with a prostitute, he kills himself rather than face his mother's disapproval. The rebel is murdered next. In the same novel, the brash Irishman, Randall Patrick McMurphy, is smothered in his bed. The witness, the unspeaking big chief, breaks out of the heavily barred ward and escapes into the world to relate the story. Likewise, in The Great Gatsby, the desperate Myrtle Wilson throws herself in front of a car. From the first time she enters the story, Fitzgerald describes her as a suicide. Soon after, the new money Jay Gatsby is shot to death in his swimming pool. Following that, the narrator, Nick Carraway, sounds like Carraway, escapes back to the Midwest and delivers the story's takeaway lesson. This is not the only model, but it is the ideal for Americans, and the enduring success of any book is determined by how close the story hews to this pattern. Often, outspoken female characters aren't killed. Instead, they're banished or shunned. In Gone with the Wind, the obedient Melanie Wilkes chooses to die, attempting to have a child she's been told will kill her, but wanting to please her husband with a large family. In the next turn, the bold Scarlett O'Hara is excommunicated from her community and her family, while the understated Rhett Butler takes his leave for Charleston, escaping the scene like Big Chief and Nick Carraway. The same variation takes place in Valley of the Dolls, where the beautiful Jennifer North works constantly to please her mother, but finally kills herself out of the fear that a tumor in her breast will destroy her beauty. The ambitious, outspoken Neely O'Hara, a fictional character who's chosen her stage name from an earlier fictional character, is soon discarded for her show business transgressions. And the book ends on the placid, ethereal Anne Wells. The outsider, an escapee from a distant New England family not unlike Big Chief's tribe, as the most unscathed. In the Dead Poets Society, a student commits suicide out of fear of his father's disapproval. A teacher is banished for being unorthodox, and an outsider is left as the witness. Even a seemingly transgressive novel, like Fight Club, traced the same pattern. The most inventive aspect of Fight Club was how it collapsed all three of the archetypes. By killing himself, the martyr murders the rebel, and by doing so creates an integrated passive-active voice that recounts the story as a new self-aware narrator. Over and over, the lesson to Americans is not to be too passive or aggressive, but to pay attention and to avoid notice. To escape, to survive and tell the tale. To believe Talbot, half the population of the formerly United States was always forced to live as the slaves of the other half. And this relationship shifted almost every 4 years. Voters were compelled to be slaves or tyrants, tyrants or slaves, depending on election results. Their literature was calibrated to keep people sane despite these wild reversals of power. Terence closed the book and held it in his lap. If merely to stay alive, that's what Terence wanted to do. Escape this formula altogether. And that's why he knew he'd have to find another option. Something a lifetime of books and movies hadn't primed him to choose. Half alive, Talbot had admitted to having no tracking device. It had all been a lie. It was a test to see how far Walter would go to achieve his goals. How mercilessly he could act. Sputtering the words, breathless and bone pale, ashen-lipped, the old man had said,
"I am so proud of you."
Walter, not the same Walter. Walter had turned into someone he didn't know. He was slick with the old man's blood, stiff-fingered. His new old man had gasped,
"I am very proud of you."
His eyelids had fluttered, and he'd faltered as if ready to die, but he'd rallied. Fixing Walter with red-rimmed eyes, he'd said,
"Listen closely," he'd said, "for I am agreed to teach you all the secrets of success."
He'd swallowed hard and coughed to clear his throat.
"Write this down," he'd ordered. "Write Declaration of Interdependence."
And at the old man's urging, Walter had rushed away to find a pen and a notebook. Shasta checked the battery icon on her phone and pressed the switch to turn it off. The battery showed as mostly dead. She knew the feeling. She watched Talbot Reynolds on television and tried to feel reassured. Not everyone was terrified. The man who delivered firewood. Her professors who weren't shot dead and being buried in the pit on the soccer practice fields. Most people appeared to be exuberant about the reshaping of society. None of the old solutions had done anything but make social problems worse. People seemed willing to try something radically different. What the Talbot book referred to wasn't a wholly new concept. Leading political figures like Keith Ellison had long before called for separate homelands. In fact, Talbot's plan mimicked Ellison's by requiring southern states to be united as a single nation, to be occupied exclusively by people of African descent. The remaining states would be reserved exclusively for citizens of European ancestry. With the exception of California, The Sunshine State would be set aside for a special purpose. Strange newscasters appeared on television to replace those who'd been targeted. They explained how the national census and college applications provided the initial roles for racial identification. To further refine the process, the data of internet-based genetic testing services were subpoenaed. The Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act was, no duh, suspended. The popularity of such testing had established a ready-made roster for identifying those citizens in each region who would need to be relocated and compensated. Shasta didn't want to be caught in a dragnet, blindsided by a skeleton in her genetic closet. To play it safe, she'd found a website that still took Bitcoin, and she submitted a saliva sample under a fake name. They were to send her the test results by text message to a mobile phone she'd bought from a ragged hobo on Martin Luther King Boulevard. The stranger had asked for $50 cash and didn't offer a charging cord. Fingerprints of dried blood suggested a violent past, but Shasta was quick to scrub them off with an antibacterial wipe at Safeway. The battery was half dead when she got it. The waiting was worse than a pregnancy test. She tried to calm her nerves with the reminder that both of her parents were white. Both pairs of her grandparents were white. Still, the wait felt worse than some AIDS test. In the new world decreed by the Declaration of Interdependence, a great many people were enduring the same ordeal. Others, interracial couples and families mostly, were making a beeline for the Canadian border and seeking refugee status. Others had self-exiled to Europe or Mexico, but the Talbot Book decreed doing so meant forfeiting the bulk of their property and assets. It proposed like-for-like compensation only for citizens who willingly surrendered their homes and businesses and relocated to the appropriate homeland. On television, Talbot Reynolds assuaged fears, repeating that the death squads had completed their work. Those who'd liberated the formerly United States would oversee the relocation process with only the force appropriate to any resistance they met. As she carried the switched-off phone, trying to save the battery for the eventual text, Shasta wrestled with the idea of imminent racial separatism. No group was a monolith, not even gays, especially not gays. Queer identity cleaved faster than a cell dividing in the uterus. Resisting the urge to power up her phone, Shasta recalled the brilliant writer Zora Neale Hurston from Black History Month, who said African Americans come in high yellow, yellow, high brown, Vaseline brown, seal brown, low brown, dark brown. Not to be outdone by the cream of the Harlem Renaissance, Shasta systematically broke down whiteness to the following scale: rice white, buttermilk, been in prison pale, vampire, peeled potato, ecru, grocery bag, regular Barbie. As far as she knew, she was no more ethnic than peeled potato. There was no telling how much time had elapsed, but she couldn't resist any longer. She switched on the phone. It chimed with a new text. Talbot, on television, over the radio, decreed temporary measures. All public employees must remain servants of the people. They must forget their dreams of early retirement. Yes, they'd postpone their dreams in exchange for security and the promise that one day the young would relieve them. But now, the young had seized control and were giddy with power. Boys who'd never expected to attain drinking age, they'd been granted a future, and the last thing they wanted was to deliver mail or write parking tickets. So Talbot had called a temporary halt to retirements and sabbaticals and vacations in the public sector, strictly as a short-term stopgap measure. For how long, no one could say. Exempt were the police and military, for they had aided the tribes. For a period, the nation continued to lurch forward, headless. The agencies whose purpose it was to deliver mail and write parking tickets continued to deliver mail and to write parking tickets, because they could rally no counterattack, and because no one knew who the attackers had been in the first place, and because no one wanted to draw the focus and become the next target. The threat of repercussions prompted public employees to rethink any bad mood. It motivated with less carrot, all stick. To preempt further violence, Talbot appeared on billboards, a beaming image of him, with the slogan, "A smile is your best bulletproof vest." The same image and slogan appeared on posters in bus stops and in employee lunchrooms. People recognized it was a smile or be shot edict, but what choice did they have? It became not uncommon to see clerks in the post office grinning widely, while beads of sweat blistered their foreheads. For their sole exit strategy was via a dirt hole filled with quicklime. Thus, public employees constituted a new serf class, tied to their tasks, held like chattels. As per the Talbot book, people were kept confused, living on the brink of chaos for so long that they'd be grateful to accept the terms of any new governing body. The word grateful falls short. Absent the constant threat of death, they were gleeful, joyous with relief, willing to pledge allegiance to any new order, so long as it kept the peace. Money was no longer power, merely a short-lived tool. The dollar, Talbot declared, was dead, and the new currency had to flow downward through the members of each lineage, through the members to their families and loved ones. Even so, the new currency was short-lived, fading to plastic film in fewer than 100 days. And because money could no longer be hoarded, it had to be traded for bread and wine. And because more bread and wine were needed, more people were employed in raising wheat and growing grapes. And always, there was the possibility of a new list. This one directed at unpopular bus drivers and meter maids. And this spurred terrified smiles and a groveling humility among civil servants. Everyone else kept a low profile, and for once, were glad not to be government workers. To the millennials of the youth bulge, the street sweeper was just as guilty as the senator, and just as ready to see the new generation marched off to war. Just as the French Reign of Terror had commenced by beheading royals, then expanded to severing the heads of clerics and clerks and servants, the danger existed that Adjustment Day would become an annual event. From when it broke over the distant horizon, the figure looked like a haunt, thin and shimmering in the desert heat, wavering, flickering like a flame. It grew taller with each step along the highway. It brought to mind abandoned animals, the dogs poor people took out to the countryside to dump, hoping household pets could fend for themselves. Starved a few days, those lapdogs and pedigreed mutts always resort to eating the shit of other animals. That shit, laced with the eggs of black flies, eggs ready to hatch out worms. The result being, a dumped animal starves all the faster, eating more shit, hatching more mouths to feed, and finally finding a bush, a tree, a fence, but shade enough where a poor animal can collapse, panting, and die. That's what the ghostly figure brought to mind. Garrett Dawson had only to turn his head to watch the stranger's progress. Former shop steward, prince of Caucasia's most powerful lineage, he lay on the dusty roadside. With his top half under his truck, his hands twisted a bearing cap off the driveline U-joint. His legs stretched across the road's gravel shoulder, full in the hot sunshine, until his jeans felt steam iron to his legs, and his toes felt baked inside his boots. He picked the needle bearings from the cap and cleaned each in his mouth, spitting away the burnt grease. Peeking to see the stranger come another stretch closer. By feel, his fingers pressed the bearings back into their race. The differential input yoke was almost too hot to touch. His toolbox, set half in the shade, socket sets and extensions just a long reach away. The radio was playing, turned up so he could listen. That man, Talbot, was on. No music, no broadcast ball games. The entirety of television and radio played nothing but Talbot Reynolds, new ruling potentate. Most likely he lived in a castle, lucky some bitch. Waited on hand and foot by teenage virgins. The voice rattled in his tinny dash speakers. Paradise isn't created by splendid architecture or dramatic scenery, but by the quality of souls that populate the place. The great man's voice echoed across the sand and sagebrush. In the time since Dawson had first heard his bearing burn out, not one car had gone past. His visitor, he could see, was something womany. Minus her dusty clothes, he figured she hadn't the booty to hide her back hole. And what the sun had done to her blistered skin, it had done twice over to her scorched hair. The wind had knotted the strands, and sweat had plastered it flat to her head with dust. Talbot's voice declared, "If a man can face reality at the age of 25, at 60, he can dictate it." She didn't look like much, but just in case, Dawson slipped off his wedding ring and stuffed it in a front pocket of his jeans. He rolled a needle bearing in his mouth, sucking off the scorched grease. He spat black. Tucked deep in his pocket, his fingertips felt a slip of something. A sheet of paper. Wadded and soft with age, the paper listed the items he'd promised his wife Roxanne he'd bring home. Her handwriting would be illegible now, creased with wrinkles and washed with his sweat. But he knew the list by heart. Coffee filters, AA batteries for kitchen remote, avocados, not Haas, toilet paper, peacock tongues. Life hadn't slowed any, he reckoned. Except now, they measured their passing days in peacock tongues. A heartbeat later, the abandoned woman had staggered within spitting distance. She'd come to stand beside his rig, his toolbox at her feet. As she edged within hearing of the radio, the woman hesitated, as if spooked by the voice. The radio preached, "When they run, hunt them. Find the stragglers where they shelter. The shame they feel comes from squandering the authority built up for them by generations of fathers." To Dawson's mind, there were different degrees of sunburn. First was roofer's tan, from laying tar paper and stapling shingles on plywood decking, angled to offer a man like so much blistering steak for the sun to broil. The even darker shades included, cast away in a lifeboat in the open ocean, liver-colored, Hawaiian Tropic SPF No. 5 Bondi Beach under the ozone hole suicide red, Bain de Soleil, Saint-Tropez orange, Arnold Schwarzenegger roll-on protan bronze, demented Tucson bag lady baked brown. This stranger was none of the above. Her sunburn red had blistered and peeled away to reveal ovals of lily white. Hers was the first sun exposure of a cosseted lifetime. Dawson's lips, he figured, were black with grease, but hers were frosted white with flakes of dried skin. Her teeth looked straight and white as a movie star's. It was common knowledge that many targets had sidestepped Adjustment Day. Mostly academics had managed to evade squads, since schools of higher learning kept notoriously erratic schedules. Word was, these fugitives were playing dress-up in rags and trying to pass themselves off as normals while they picked their way toward the Canadian border. Mexico didn't want them. But Canada hadn't closed the door entirely. Washington State Route 21 rolled north across the Caliche scablands of eastern Washington State, straight to the border. But only a born idiot would hike it in hot weather. If there was anything Dawson knew about academics, it was the fact that they weren't too bright. The closest town back that ways was Colotus, A good 12 clicks. She stepped closer to his toolbox and squatted down to see under the truck. "Hey, mister," she drawled. Her voice sounded put on, picked up from reruns of Hee-Haw or the Beverly Hillbillies. "Hitch a ride?" Dawson rolled to one side, facing her. He snaked the phone from his shirt pocket and framed her blistered face. If the stranger knew about the face recognition software, she was too tired to care. He snapped a picture and texted it. To test her, he held out his hand, palm up. "You want to reach me that 7/8 extra deep socket on the offset extension?" Her faded blue eyes went to the array of chrome tools in the box's top tray. Her eyes twitched over the hex nut drivers and snap wrenches. Roxanne would have known the correct tool on sight. To show his impatience, he snapped his grease-stained fingers. Could be a heartbeat later, she slapped something hot metal into his hand, and when he brought it into sight, it was a closed-in 5/8 wrench. His phone chimed. The database had her pegged. This starved wretch, crouched here, her feet flapping in torn basketball shoes, her legs and arms lost in baggy coveralls patched with duct tape, the tape curled up at the edges and black with grime. Her name was Ramantha. She'd gone missing from the University of Oregon, where she'd headed the Selected Gender Pathways Department. But she was a dead academic walking. A small army of bounty hunters were closing in, fast. The nearest was only a little ways back, and here she'd wandered into Dawson's life. A windfall, already doomed. Her vote tally was a measly 1,100. It wasn't a dynasty. But he could make a small fortune by voting the way of the highest bidder every election. Whether he could murder her, and how, was another question. Maybe she read this in his eyes. She said, "I suppose you're going to kill me?" Her voice had lost its yokel twang. It sounded cosmopolitan, cultured. Nowadays, cultured was bad. Cultured got you killed. From the cab of the truck, Talbot lectured at full volume. Adjustment Day is not about vengeance. The hunter does not hate the elk. He holds great respect for his prey. But the hunter knows the animal must die for his own survival. It struck Dawson as a shame. Looking at her, destitute like this, grit crusted around her cracked nostrils and caked in the corners of her mouth, her neck festering with mosquito bites and raw scratch marks, hidden under her unwashed stench and her claptrap political ideology, he could tell she had once been a pretty fine-looking young lady. She twisted her neck to look back over one shoulder. Squinting, her eyes searched the horizon for pursuers. To no one in particular, she said, "It wasn't some run-of-the-mill panty raid." Hoarse with misery, her voice was barely audible. "They had guns. The squads had left her alive," she said, "and they'd ordered her to haul her dead co-workers to the burial pits. My entire staff." Not a heartbeat later, her knees buckled, and she dropped from squatting to kneeling defeated in the sharp gravel. With her head bowed, her hair dangled to hide her face. A human sacrifice. She dug a linoleum knife out of his toolbox and offered it. "Take it," she said. "I'm begging." Her other hand drew the fried hair back to uncover her ear. "Cut it off, but take me to the border, please." She knelt there in the dust as if too tired to run any farther. If he didn't target her, someone else would. Torture or not, she wanted him to report her as dead. He'd pocket the votes, and she'd escape into Canada. What was left of her. It looked like a win-win. Again Dawson snapped his fingers, but this time pointed at the socket he wanted. The first bounty hunter was liable to catch up soon.
"Samantha," he said.
"Ramantha," she said, correcting him. She had that much pride left. She set aside the knife and retrieved the socket. She seemed to get the message. Nobody was getting carved up, and nobody was going anywhere until he could get this driveline attached. A regular notebook hadn't worked. In a world before the list, the world you think is so stable, Walter hadn't been able to write that fast. No one could have, not as fast as Talbot Reynolds had talked, crazed as he'd been. Giddy with blood loss from the razor nicks and diggings that had kept leaking blood, his head had lolled and his eyelids had fluttered, woozy with the ecstasy of his pain. Still naked and strapped to a chair that stood in the puddle of the great man's own sweat and piss and blood, long strings of spit had looped from the corners of his mouth as he raved. A jabbering cadaver, an oracle delirious on an overdose of endorphins. A notebook hadn't worked, so Walter had traded it for a laptop computer. His fingers racing to keep abreast of Talbot's words. How this was going to make his fortune so he could propose to Shasta, Walter had no idea. As he tapped the keys, his fingertips left red fingerprints, leaving the keyboard sticky. Spirals and whirls of Talbot's blood. Talbot dictated, "The homosexual will always be an engine of wealth production because he does not suffer the expense of raising his own children." He paused to watch Walter, to be certain his words were not wasted. "The next generation of homosexuals," he continued, "is always born and raised by heterosexuals before leaving to join its brethren. Thus, the industry of the adult homosexual may accumulate while the industry of heterosexuals is siphoned away for child-rearing costs, which ultimately benefit the homosexual community." Walter completed the passage, repeating aloud, "homosexual community," to indicate he'd caught up. "Plus, the time of the homosexual," Talbot lectured, "is not frittered away in child production and may be allocated to improving his skill set or simply laboring longer hours without the cost of neglecting a family." Walter keyboarded, echoing the final words aloud. "The homosexual state will always enjoy a cost-free influx of new citizens." To date, the rich man had advised Walter to present a pattern and allow other men to fulfill it. Walter was to set in motion a machine that no one would be able to stop, a machine that would run itself, that even Walter would not be able to stop. How this would make him rich, Walter hadn't the foggiest. Like most writers, he'd been too busy typing to think. "In order to preserve the integrity of mutually exclusive hetero and homosexual nation-states," Talbot continued, "the heterosexual children born to lesbians and the homosexuals born to heterosexuals must be swapped." Walter completed the sentence aloud, "in equal numbers." Talbot had gasped. His mutilated torso had twisted against his bonds. "If an unequal number of persons must be exchanged." Speaking the words as he typed them, Walter had said, "then a dowry or ransom will be paid to compensate the parents not receiving a child." So it had gone, day after day. The old man had spewed words and Walter had faithfully collected them. The only other task, the only tangible task that Talbot had ordered him to carry out, was to build a website. Whenever the man had slept, Walter had tinkered with the website, and it was almost complete. Apropos of nothing, as if in a moment of delirium, The old man had fixed Walter with a manic grin and shouted, "A smile is your best bulletproof vest." Gibberish or not, Walter keyed the words into his document. Trusting, always faithful that the ramblings of this old coot were going somewhere, that he wasn't wasting his life documenting the dying words of a lunatic. The website, for instance, the one Talbot had told him to build, it hardly seemed like a high-tech moneymaker. It still hadn't launched, not yet, but Walter had built it exactly according to Talbot's instructions, right down to the stupid name. A nothing name. Nothing clever. This yammering, grimacing, demented old man had demanded the site be called simply The List. The post office clerk reached under her side of the counter and retrieved a form. Form number 346, application for resettlement in appropriate homeland. As she handed the paper across the counter to Gavin, she smiled, licking her lips, and said, "Funny, but you don't look black." Gavin took the form, saying, "I'm not." Her eyes lingered over his hair, such red hair, his wide jawline, his broad chest, and she sighed. What a crying shame. What could he say? He'd done nothing wrong. He was simply following the new law. Gavin told her thanks and took the form to a counter under the windows where he could fill it out. People stood in line waiting to mail packages. People waited to exchange small amounts of their old money for the new, perishable skins money. The first line of the form asked for his name. "Gavin Baker McInnes," he wrote. He filled in his place of residence, his current homeland, his parents' names. Under age, he wrote, 18. At work skills, he hesitated. He was an expert at many things, none of which he could enter on any official government form. Under highest level of education attained, he wrote that he'd graduated from high school and gave the date. It had been yesterday. Before Adjustment Day, before any talk of homelands and relocating populations accordingly, back in 9th grade, Gavin had learned a thing or two. For instance, he knew that teachers teach a lot of stuff, but only what they want a kid to know. The important things he'd have to discover on his own. He'd listened as his teacher, a woman who'd never been beyond North America, explained the whole of Europe and Asia. Gavin had taken notes as another teacher, who'd never written so much as a short story, dissected Faulkner, Fitzgerald, and Donne. When he echoed back their pale misconceptions, they praised him and pronounced him smart. Smart. Yes. Smart enough to know he still understood nothing, and that his teachers were idiots. Nothing except his own hunt in the real world would ever educate him. Under reason for relocation, again he hesitated. Gavin craved a happiness that would make his parents vomit to witness. He yearned for a love that would completely destroy their love for him. His life was an either-or proposition. He'd someday have to choose between his own happiness and theirs. Under criminal record, he lied and wrote, "None." Officially, that was true. He didn't want his relocation to be nixed for any reason.